Welcome to Elixir Wizards, a podcast brought to you by Smart Logic,
a custom web and mobile development shop.
This is season 13, The Creators Lab, where we're talking to innovators who are expanding what's possible with Elixir.
From groundbreaking projects to tools shaping the future with our favorite technology.
It may seem like magic, but it's really the result of talent and lots of hard work.
Hey everyone, I'm Dan Ivovich, Director of Engineering at Smart Logic.
And I'm Charles Suggs, software developer at SmartLogic. We're your hosts today for episode 5. We're joined by Owen Bickford, Elixir Wizard and creator of the Web Auth and Components Library for Phoenix LiveView. In this episode, we're discussing Owen's work creating a hex package for passwordless authentication to LiveView applications. Welcome to the show, Owen.
What's happening?
Many time host, first time guest.
Right. Long time, first time. I've never been a guest on this podcast, have I?
Not that I can recall. So, yeah. Oh, why don't you tell us about yourself?
Right. So I am a co-host of a little podcast you may have heard of called Elixir Wizards. You should check it out sometime. And I've been fortunate enough to write Elixir full-time since 2021. So just over 3 years. Wrote some Elixir for fun before that and PHP, some JavaScript as well. Enjoying my career as a software engineer. And I'm actually really excited that we're getting to talk about passkeys, because this is actually one of those rare technologies that improves security without making your users miserable.
It's a tall order there.
Tall order, yes.
So why don't you start off by setting the stage? Why passkeys? Where did we start? Where did we go? Why are we here?
Okay. Buckle up. It's going to be a journey. This has been, 50 years or more of evolution on how you authenticate a person on a system. So that's what passkeys is all about. So I'll try to speed run the history of how we got to passkeys, right? So our audience is mostly engineers, software engineers. So typically when you're writing an application, whether that's Elixir or any other application, if you need to protect access to the application, you're going to require an email and password. That's a kind of like bare minimum, right? That's kind of like the most common way of authenticating a user. Authenticating means like confirming that the person is who they say they are. Now, it's imperfect. There has been an evolution of maybe several decades ago, you would put just a password in a file or in a database just as raw text. And then whenever a person types it in the browser, you would just compare the strings. And if they're exactly the same, you would let them in. But then you've got problems with databases can be compromised, data leaks. So then we evolved to encode and hash, salt and hash our passwords with all these different encryption methods. So your application would have something called a secret key. And whenever a user would enter a password, you would do some math to kind of hash and salt the password using one of a set of algorithms. And then that would go in, that, you know, encrypted password would go into the database. So that was an improvement to plain text passwords. But then the next challenge is that, well, actually, once enough of those have been saved to databases and those databases have been compromised, there's something called a rainbow table where at least common passwords and phrases can be easily decrypted using something called a rainbow table, which is just kind of a table of previously unencrypted or decrypted passwords that have been compromised. One of the main problems is that actual real-world users tend to reuse passwords across multiple sites. We're expecting our users to remember a password, and they'll typically use password 123 or something kind of contrived to get into some of their most sensitive accounts, which is really bad. And, you know, it's been kind of a whack-a-mole cat and mouse kind of game of improving security and also putting a bunch of requirements on users to keep changing how they, you know, generate passwords, what those passwords should include, how frequently they should change. And none of that actually solves the problem of protecting access to the secrets for these users. The next step in the evolution, I think, would be multi-factor authentication. So if you're looking at an application that has multi-factor, you're usually signing in with a username or email in addition to a password. And then once you provide a correct match of identity and password, then the application is going to ask you to confirm a code, either through a phone text message, SMS, or it's going to send you a code through email, or it's going to send you a code through a one-time password application. Each of those is vulnerable in different ways. Your phone can be hijacked. This is a thing that is unfortunately maybe less easy to do now, but still probably not impossible, where a person can impersonate you whenever they call your phone provider and tell them they need to activate a new SIM. And then, long story short, once they do that, they get access to all of the incoming calls and text messages. There's also some other ways of working around the system, even without having your SIM replaced, that we don't have to get into. Email can also be compromised. You know, your email, whether it's Gmail or Yahoo is notoriously been compromised several times over the years, but your email might be compromised. So those authentication codes that were supposed to go to you might be going to someone else instead. And then the fun part about the one-time password application is that it's possible to create a site that looks like the authentication site, which is generating a code or accepting a code. But, you know, what you're actually giving is you're giving the code to a bad actor instead of the actual site that you're trying to access. Usually you can kind of tell by the URL, but sometimes they're just different by a single character. Maybe it's an I instead of an L. And if your provider hasn't bought up all the possible domains, then they're kind of vulnerable to that compromise. So that's the evolution of passwords. It's probably skipped over a lot of different nuances and details and things that have happened over the past several decades. But that's kind of like, I think, the evolution of passwords and authentication before we even get to passkeys and the underlying tech there.
Awesome. So yes, we have the current slash hopefully fading mess of passwords and MFA and sites that look like they're real but aren't. So enter, I think at this stage then, right, enter WebAuthn, which is where the namesake of your library comes from?
Yes. And actually, I just remember there's one other type of authentication that's actually fairly common, which is third-party authentication or OAuth, open authentication. Open Connect ID, there's like different flavors of this, but You might, as an application developer, you might decide, I don't want to deal with all that complexity with passwords and vulnerabilities and storing all that information in my database. So one other option up until now has been that you can actually just trust a different vendor. So you can allow people to sign in using their Google account, their GitHub account, or, you know, whatever, like sometimes the social providers. So it kind of depends on your application and which providers your users are likely to be coming from. But there's trade-offs even with that. It might be more secure than the password mechanisms, but then you're locking your users into remaining on that platform, especially if there's no alternative authentication methods. So all of that history kind of leads us up to something called passkeys, which is a culmination of lots of years and lots of development from people throughout the industry. And it's built on top of a technology called WebAuthn or web authentication. So in the browser, which is where I work most of the time as I'm building web applications, there's an API built into the browsers. It goes back several years now, but it's called WebAuthn API. And so it provides a mechanism for an application to request existing credentials and create new credentials for users. And there's a little bit of a dance that happens between the server or your application and the client or the browser to, you know, to check, is this supported? Are we creating or retrieving a credential? And then, you know, there's attestations and a bunch of other kind of steps along that process. So that's at a very high level what passkeys are. Passkeys is actually kind of a nice kind of rebranding of WebAuthn. WebAuthn is kind of like a developer-y kind of term. I wouldn't expect most of my family to understand. If I just said WebAuthn, their eyes would immediately glaze over. I think with passkeys, at least they might be a little bit intrigued. What passkeys does, aside from just giving us a simpler, you know, a better brand for this type of thing, is it was an effort by all of the operating systems and hardware vendors to build in support. So there's a couple of things you need in order to support passkeys. You know, the browser is going to support the WebAuthn API, but the browser needs, or the operating system needs to be able to support, you know, biometrics. So we have Face ID, Touch ID on most of our Android and Mac devices. Windows has Windows Hello, if I remember correctly. Linux has different implementations, I think, for supporting passkeys as well. And then also most of the hardware will have a trusted it's a TPM. It's Trusted Platform Module, if I think is the term. So I think most devices that support passkeys are using the TPM module buried deep within the laptop or the phone to manage the actual credential generation and storage.
All right. So back to Elixir then. All this stuff exists. Yes. LiveView exists. You are one of the most pro LiveView people I've ever met. So you made a library. What was it trying to do and why'd you do it?
I think really what I was trying to do was build on the success of the Phoenix Gen auth. So, you know, someone, I forget who originally developed that as a package. It was external to Phoenix. If you rewind maybe 3 to 5 years, there had been several different authentication packages. I think UberAuth, POW, I think Ascent is another one. And we hadn't really, as a community, settled on one kind of blessed path for authentication. And there's still a lot of variety in the ecosystem. But someone somewhere along the way developed a package for generating code on Phoenix applications so that you would run a command, it would inject a bunch of code into your app for creating users and user sessions and tokens, as well as automating a lot of the setup you'd have to do manually for adding, you know, users, encrypting passkeys, using the correct or the most trusted encryption methods and that kind of stuff. I think it was successful enough that it did eventually get rolled into Phoenix proper. So it's now, if you generate a new Phoenix application, I think by default, or maybe it's a command you run later on, but you can get all this authentication stuff kind of baked in. It is still username or email and password. So it's still using kind of the, you know, the password as your secret, which is still susceptible to all the vulnerabilities that we talked about previously. But as a kind of like a North Star of how to implement passkeys, that's kind of where I started. So you mentioned LiveView and me being such a rabid LiveViewer, a LiveView slinger. I've been on the LiveView hype train for a long, long time now. And thank you, Dan, for letting me write LiveView at work. This was, I think, 2021, 2022, over the summer. I was kind of getting ready for ElixirConf, and this might have been a conference-driven development thing. I don't actually remember the details now because it's been a while. But leading up to that conference, I wanted to give a talk about WebAuthn because I think I'd just been kind of casually studying it a little bit. And so anyway, spent a few months kind of reading up, experimenting, doing a bunch of trial and error, and came up with a package that essentially does the same thing as Phoenix GenAuth. But it's an external package, so it has its own place in the Hex package manager, and it has its own tasks now. Basically, what it does is it establishes a bunch of live components that are actually being used from the package, and then it generates a bunch of code for you. So it generates migrations for your users table, user tokens, I think, which is following some of the same patterns as the auth generator. And then it injects some live views as well. So you get a registration and then an authentication live view. Those used to be a single live view. And so what that's intended to do is kind of give you like a starting point, which might be good enough for your prototype application or your MVP. But it also gives you the ability to customize the appearance of the components. You can pass in Tailwind classes to the buttons, for example. And you can also kind of reconfigure if you don't like the way the migrations look, if you want to add or remove columns, or if you want to switch from email to username or vice versa, then it gives you the flexibility before you actually put this in your repo to override the defaults there. So that's kind of what happens. And the way you do this is you add WebAuthn components as your dependency on your Phoenix application. You fetch your dependencies. Then once you run mix help, you'll see a couple of tasks from this package. And if I remember correctly, it's wac.install, wac.install. So I think I'm going to rename that. I can come back to some of the plans I have for the future later on. But yeah, you wac install, and then you get the live views, the migrations, and all the stuff for supporting passkeys. If it works as well as it has worked for me when I've tried it out, then you run this command within 5 minutes, you've got passkey support for your Phoenix application. One trade-off there is that it doesn't play nicely yet with the default Phoenix authentication generator. So it expects that you have not run that already. I'm not sure yet if that's something I want to support, but that's just something to know before you start down that path.
You mentioned about in the initial migrations that it generates, that it sets up, I think, an email column in the database table for users, or that you could change it to username or something. But is it possible to just have no identifier aside from, say, the user's public key or something, so that there's even less identifying information in the application?
Yes. And this is something I've kind of gone back and forth on. Technically, you can generate passkeys without any username or email. The tricky thing there is that practically for the user, you're going to provide something called a display name, which is going to show them whenever they actually look at their passkeys later on, it's going to show them a username or email, assuming you continue using an email or username. If you opted out of that, then I think the only fallback would be the domain or the origin, mm-hmm. which would be your site. So like if you're doing this on localhost, all passkeys that you would generate would just say localhost, and you wouldn't be able to distinguish between separate users. So something that happens in the real world is a user might have separate accounts, or you might have a family using a single computer or sharing. And there's a bunch of different reasons that you want people to be able to create separate accounts from the same device. So I think that's one reason you do probably want to have some form of identification. Email, like you said, is PII, or personally identifiable information. So a username might be a better default. Mm-hmm. Also, emails change and you have to confirm and that kind of thing. So I think I'm more in the camp of using username as the identifier, and then we can dig into what is a passkey maybe as the next topic here. Did that answer your question?
Yeah, and that is a good segue to talk about what is a passkey, what is that? Yeah, I think it's asymmetric key cryptography that it's based on. How does that offflow work?
Right, so I think before we actually even try to explain what that is, I think if you're a developer listening to this podcast and you've ever signed in to SSH on any kind of machine, even if it's just GitHub, you have generated an SSH key, which is asymmetric cryptography. These words really trip me up. But it's essentially, you're getting kind of two secrets. So you get a public key and a private key. The private key stays on your device, so on your computer, your machine, your laptop, or maybe even your password manager. And then the public key is actually shared with the application. So that's the part that goes up to the cloud, goes to the server, goes to GitHub, goes wherever, you know, depending on where you're signing in. I think I would leave it to the documentation, the experts, to kind of explain in depth the algorithms and how all of this works. I'm more of a user and like kind of package implementer of that stuff. So I know there's like the ed something something some number algorithm is like the one I typically use, because that's the new secure default. It's more secure than RSA, I think, from what I remember. But essentially, passkeys work the same way as those SSH keys that you generate. You get a public and private key. This all goes through that browser WebAuthn API. If you're developing on native apps, I think they all support passkeys as well. The API may not be WebAuthn. It may be something slightly different. But if we're talking about Chrome, Safari, Firefox, probably not Internet Explorer anymore, but if you're on the modern browsers, then you're talking about WebAuthn API. And so you call the API, there's documentation we could point to for kind of going through the dance of creating a credential, getting the metadata about the credential back up to the server. And then whenever the user returns to the site, then they tell the site who they want to sign in as, using probably a username, like we said, potentially an email address, depending on your site's implementation. And then your site would fetch, if it finds a valid credential, it's going to fetch the public key and maybe a key ID, if I remember correctly, and it's going to tell the browser, this is the key that the user is attempting to use. So we're not going to let them sign in as anything else but the credential that matches this key ID and public key. So once the user is presented with a prompt, as long as they use their face ID, touch ID, they could even use an operating system PIN or password. Once they go through that process, then the device, the browser, will generate a signature, send a bunch of data back up to the server. and the server will kind of validate that. There's a whole challenge and attestation process that's part of this. And assuming everything goes successfully, then the user is authenticated to the application. In the case of web authentic components, we create a new session in the user sessions table, or I think it's user tokens specifically. So we create a session token, mm-hmm. and then that allows them to be signed in without having to constantly reactivate the passkey whenever they go to a new page.
So yeah, it does have parallels to like the SSH key kind of approach, right? But it's because it's baked into the browser, you're getting this extra layer of they're being generated per origin and they're locked to that origin, right? And so like a fraudulent site that tries to look exactly like it would have to exploit like an issue in the browser to even get that workflow to start for that credential to try to even get it to run through somewhere else. And then on the back end, without the matching public key, it's useless to you anyway to like, you never get the secret. You know, you're just communicating, you know, encryption and decryption back and forth, you know, asymmetrically, mm-hmm. which is cool.
Right. Very cool. Once you know enough about security, it's really hard to call anything bulletproof.
Sure.
But this one feels pretty good, right? It's like the glass is pretty thick on this, at least.
I think where I struggle with it are the implementation details, and that's where I'm really interested to mm-hmm. talk about like how mm-hmm. you have decided to make these components work and where they kind of fit in. Because I always see the issue with like, I guess if you're using a password manager and now with like iCloud keychains and things like that, this is becoming less of an issue. And I know, I think they're working on a spec change too, to be able to make passkeys kind of have like an export format that can have some amount of security to it to get them into somewhere else. But it's like you generate this thing that's stuck on your device. And if it's the only thing that identifies you, I can never go to another device and log in and then add a new like passkey as a like second alternative, because this is a different device right. I use. Again, this can be solved through Cloud Sync, but now you have this like syncing vault that is another vulnerability. Mm-hmm. And so like there's a mental hurdle there. And I think that's why I'm curious how you think about this and how you think about it in the terms of the library. I feel like what we're seeing a lot of is the passkey is replacing a second factor as opposed to being the only factor. So I think like GitHub is probably the thing our listeners are most commonly using. Your second factor in GitHub can be a passkey. So you still authenticate, or you can still authenticate, and then it will, your username and password, and then it will say, okay, you know, do you want to provide a time-based one-time code, use a hardware authenticator, or use a passkey?
Yeah.
From your library, where do you see that playing out?
Yeah, so for the package, I think it's a little bit more agnostic. It probably starts as just like the authentication method. It's not mm-hmm. a multi-factor step. So there are no passwords. If you run Phoenix new and then you add WebAuthn components and WAC install, you're not dealing with passwords at all. You don't have to store them. You don't have to encrypt them and decrypt them. You don't have to worry about anyone compromising the database and having a password that might've been used elsewhere. It's just not a thing you have to think about. I do think it's secure, and I think you bring up a good point. So I think because it's a new technology, it's not the case that like everybody's comfortable with it being the only authentication method. There are some nuances. There's a few things I want to hit on, and I'm sure I'll forget at least a couple of them. So there's before we had passkeys, capital P passkeys, we had a thing called a YubiKey. So this type of thing right here, it's a little USB thumb drive. That it's not for storage, it actually has authentication.
I think all of us can reach for a YubiKey at this exact moment if we'd like to.
Yes. Look, we're nerds, okay? We got YubiKeys laying around. I think I've maybe gotten all my accounts to where they don't actually need these anymore, but every once in a while I still find one. I'm like, oh, I need to grab this one. So mm-hmm. so anyway, these were a second factor or a multi-factor. So it might have been possible that this could be your only factor as well. But what really kind of got me excited about these was that in the real world, Google had been fighting a bunch of battles with compromised accounts, getting, you know, their employees getting phished because they are a globally important company, right? So they're basically everyone at a company like that's going to be a target for bad actors. So using these hardware security keys, they were able to A, enforce that everyone got one and activated on their account, and then B, that reduced, I think, or maybe even eliminated all of the compromises they were facing up until that point. And then basically WebAuthn, the API for the browsers, could support passkeys, and it still does. Or I mean, could support these hardware keys. Mm-hmm. Passkeys is just a way of getting the same benefit without requiring yet another piece of physical hardware. Everyone in our world has a phone. Everyone has a laptop or tablet or some kind of device. So practically speaking, as of this year, I would say it's fairly ubiquitous in terms of support. You know, there will be exceptions, you know, where people are using a very old.
Yeah, I don't think I have a device that can't use it, right? It's really more about which sites are supporting mm-hmm. it and which scenarios.
Exactly.
I think I encountered the other day, like walmart.com supports it, but only on a mobile phone, not in desktop, which I thought was a weird choice. Mm-hmm. And yeah, and then like I mentioned, like I'm seeing some places where it is you put in your email, you know, or whatever your user identifier is, and then it will say, okay, you've opted into passkeys. So it just challenges for that and doesn't challenge for anything else. And then there's other places where I'm still seeing it as username and password. And then the second factor is, you know, one of lots of options. I think I've even seen some sites where they're like, either tap your hardware key and it'll, you know, I could still hit my existing YubiKey, or hit the, you know, okay, browser, go ahead and send my passkey over. At some level, they're kind of the same thing, right? Like, I mean, they're different pieces of the FIDO standard, but, you know, the goal is similar.
Yeah, I think the decision about whether it's your only form of authentication or it's an optional upgrade for the nerds, at this point, it's more of a business decision than a technical decision. Mm. You know, if you're at a national or international bank, you've got a huge wide variety of users, maybe with different security profiles, maybe definitely with different levels of technical ability. Mm-hmm. So you don't want to like foist a brand new technology upon everyone and then drive up your customer support costs, because what is a passkey? You know, it's going to be a very common question for maybe a large set of users. If you are someone like GitHub and your user base is highly technical developers, then maybe you don't make it a required form of authentication, but you can make it your only form of authentication for users who opt in. Hmm. So like for me, I can sign into my GitHub account with just my passkey. I think I'd still provide my email address first, or one of my many email addresses, and then it will give me the option to sign with a passkey. If for whatever reason I'm on a device that does not have access to the passkey, then I can sign in with one of my other forms that is enabled for GitHub.
Yeah.
That actually touches a little bit on cross-device support.
Yeah, I was going to say, because to me, that's the thing, is if I don't have a syncing mechanism in place, or it's not working, or if I'm, I would say offline, but then I'm not hitting a website. But, you know, like if something's not happening there, and I, you know, I'm a worry about all the worst case scenario kind of people, right? Yep. So it's like, okay, my house burns down. I didn't have my laptop with me. I did have my phone, but then it falls in a lake. Like, what's my recovery scenario? And I think that's where it's, you know, I think from a customer service standpoint, it's not just, am I familiar with the technology, but also like, what are my account recovery options?
Yeah. What happens when you lose the device that has all the keys on it?
What is the device?
Yeah.
Are we all 1Password users on this call?
I am.
Do we want to admit?
Okay. I do for work.
I feel pretty confident in their security. I'll admit that I use it.
I've also been using KeePass XC for a long time.
Let's start with users who just have a Mac, just for example. Sometime within the past year, Apple released, like, you already had keychain support for mm-hmm. your iCloud account, but I think they rolled out a separate passwords application.
In iOS 18, yeah.
Which also supports passkeys. And yeah, I know it's available on the phones and tablets. I think it may also be available on desktop as well now. But basically, that's kind of a centralized place to manage all of your passwords for legacy sites, and then passkeys for any sites where you've registered a passkey. And that's just easy mode synchronization for those passkeys and all your credentials, right? So as long as you're connected to the internet, any changes you make are synchronized to your iCloud account. 1Password is essentially the same thing, but through a separate organization. So it's an application you can install to your devices. It's also nice because it can be a browser extension for Chrome, Safari, Firefox as well. And same thing, as long as you are online at the time that you register a credential, that credential will be synced. Or I guess if you come back online later on, it will be synced as well. If you lose the physical device, like if I lose the laptop, where I've been signing in as myself across GitHub and Google and everything, I would be okay. Because what would happen is I would get a new device, sign into my iCloud account, and as long as I have a second device, I could even sign into my iCloud account potentially with a passkey, because it will ask for me to scan a QR code if it doesn't have passkey set up locally for a origin or a domain. And then I can scan that QR code on a device where I do have my password manager running. And then I can, like, it does this kind of invisible handshake to where you approve the credential from your active device, and it will enable authentication for the new device, or you know, and for the device where you haven't registered or authenticated before.
I've seen that same flow on like Matrix Chat and other kind of more security conscious tools.
Yeah. So I think we've jumped the shark off the Elixir library into like all the nuance of this. Seems like as a library author, your stance is, here's the tool, you decide what fits your business workflow. So cool. Then back to your library. Can we revisit a little bit like what you install, what's in the library, what gets copied into the app, and then like what does that upgrade process look like? You know, because I think for me, my apprehension around like authentication related libraries, especially things that bring UI along with them, is like, okay, well, I want to modify this, then I want to upgrade it because it's security, and if there's a problem, I want to upgrade it right away. But if it's going to be a pain because of everything it installed, can you just walk me through like
okay. So looking at the repo for WebAuthn components, the mixed file, I'm looking at what are my dependencies here. I think most of these are for testing and maybe for some code generation as well. So I've got Credo, Dielixir, Flowkey, and stuff like that, so I can run tests and make some assertions about the code that I've written. But there's a couple of opinions that I've baked into this. It will generate schemas with Ecto-Eulid, which just comes from my experience using UIDs, and Eulids are a little bit more user-friendly. But that's something you could opt out of. Once you run this generator, if you don't want Eulid, you would just replace those primary keys and foreign keys with UUID or just plain integer IDs if you wanted to. So the things that are generated are the live views for registration and authentication, and then the migrations and some Ecto schemas. So, and I think even a context, like there's a Phoenix context with just functions for creating, managing those users and their credentials. And then the things that are kind of outside of your application are the components. So there's a handful of components that if I perform updates to WebAuthn components, these are the things that you would, you know, run mixed steps update, and then you would have slightly different code coming from these components. So I have a handful of components here. We have a support component. So this one's very simple. It just checks. So these components are live components, and they're live components because they need to manage their own state, and they also need to communicate directly with the browser. So this is a choice I made. I could just generate the live components in your Phoenix application, generate the hook JavaScript as well, and then your live view would be responsible for handling all the messages and stuff. But that would be very brittle, and if you make any mistakes there, there would be a lot of issues, you know, coming my way for how to fix that, and it would be really hard for me to support, right? So what I do is I have, I think, three, four, five components. So the first one is support component. It uses a Phoenix hook just to see, does this browser support the browser APIs that we need, WebAuthn components in particular? And it will, if it comes back as false, we can't support that, then it will send an alert to the live view as a process message. And the generated live view code will put a flash message to the user that, sorry, we are unable to, you know, register or authenticate you because this device does not support something, not probably that verbose, but it will advise the user that web passkeys are not supported. So that's just the support component. Then in order to use passkeys, you need to be registered to a site. So the next component we could talk about is the registration component. And this is the first one where you start to see it. Dozens or hundreds of lines of code. So if I open up this module here, there's about 200 lines of code just over that. And basically what it's doing is it's using a separate package called WAX, Web Authentication. So this one, that one actually handles some of the implementation details on the kind of like the very, very back end side of things. So that's the thing that actually creates the challenge. can generate and handle attestations and stuff. And so my components are wrapping a lot of that functionality, making it easy for application developers to just kind of drop in the stuff and then update it whenever they need to. The registration component basically takes care of the whole dance of once a user clicks the registration button, take whatever form values we need. We have like a struct that defines, you know, like a name, and like we have a web auth and user struct that defines like, here's the data we need in order to actually move forward. So once you generate that or your Livy generates that, then the component manages the challenge, the attestation. And once the attestation comes back from the browser and everything passes, then we send a message to the Live View that, all right, now you can go ahead and create the user and then go through the flow of user creation, user token creation, and then signing in the user so that they can move into your application. So I'll pause there because the authentication component is also a little bit complex. This is one of those things I'm trying to describe code out loud. So yeah, it's hard to follow, I think, sometimes. But yeah, did that make sense, at least at a high level?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it did.
I'm kind of curious here. Is any of that surprising or confusing? Or are there new words that you're hearing here that we should dive into?
No, I mean, I think the place I continue to get stuck is that you start with the passkey. And, you know, just because, it still feels a little foreign to me. I'm just, I don't know, maybe I'm just being too old school about it. I totally admit that could be a thing. It's been known to happen. But, yeah, I mean, I think that the flow and what you're building and where it fits in, you know, makes sense.
I can speak to that a little bit. So there's one thing I have on my radar that I do. There's an open issue. It's probably been there for a year or more that I think I want to do, that I do want to come back around to if someone doesn't open a PR for me, is I want to support registering additional passkeys for an existing account.
Mm-hmm.
So right now, this is something a developer can kind of do manually once they've run all this, once they've run the task. They can go in, they can look at the code and say, all right, I see how to do this. I just need to go and modify this file and that file. Then I can support registering an additional passkey. It's not terribly difficult, but I want to make that easier. So I think one thing I want to do is update the user profile page or the user edit page, you know, figure out where that's going to happen, but allow adding passkeys to a single user so that would allow you to register an iCloud passkey, a 1Password passkey, a YubiKey or other devices. So that would give your most hardcore security nerds ways to provide some redundancy so they can access their account, even if Apple iCloud goes out. Isn't an outage or something. I think we can all imagine scenarios where that it might be rare, but it might happen.
Sure. Yeah.
I think the lesson of the past 10 years is don't take anything for granted. Everything can go away, right?
Right.
That would tie in nicely to being able to maybe run a different command. If you already got username and password implemented on your Phoenix application, it's possible you could run a command, or I could create a command, a task you would run that would add passkey support as a second factor or multi-factor to an account like that. I would have to kind of think through edge cases and complexities about things I would run into. So one thing I think the auth generator lets you do is choose between a controller or a live view implementation. My library is specifically for live view because it really depends on the Phoenix hooks. Because in order to do that dance without a bunch of HTTP calls,
mm-hmm.
we need to pass a bunch of messages across the WebSocket. And it's just so much easier to do that with LiveView than it would be if I was trying to add the support to a user profile controller. I'm not actually sure where I would start there. It seems like it's possible, but it would probably require a bunch more code that would add support burden. And at this point, this is just a single person repo. So
yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I have actually had some contributions over the past year or two now, so I'll take a quick moment to shout out a few people who've opened PRs and actually I've merged some of their commits. Most recently, Peaceful James out of Ireland added some, he tackled some of the issues that I'd opened, which is really helpful. Also came along and helped implement some, I think, some new features in WebAuthn, because the API is stable, but there are, I think, some incremental changes that have happened over the past couple of years. So that was nice to see. there have been a handful of other developers who have come along and picked off an issue or applied a patch to either documentation or the features themselves. And I've got a small but healthy list of issues on things that do need to be tackled sooner or later.
So this integrates with browser APIs. So you probably had to write a bit of JavaScript to make this work. How much of the code base is JavaScript versus Elixir? And would users of the library need to also have to write some JavaScript, or would folks be able to stay pretty comfy in their Elixir space?
I think I've abstracted away the JavaScript for at least for the WebAuthn passkey stuff. I'm going to take a quick look at the... So I have... There's two repos that I have here. I have the WebAuthn components, which is where the components and the generator task lives. Then I have a separate repo, which is the WebAuthn components demo. So that's an actual Phoenix app where I ran the task to show you, here's what the final code looks like if you just run with all the defaults. So the first repo, just the components, it's 90.4% Elixir, 5.9% JavaScript, and then 3.7% HTML. So that's the code in my repo that generates all the stuff. Now, if I go to the demo,
I wonder how much of that is depths versus actual like library code.
That's looking at assets. So the JavaScript lives in the package. So if you add this as your Hex package to your Phoenix application, you're not going to see a bunch of JavaScript code generated on your Phoenix app. It all lives within, this is kind of an unusual thing, right? Like we don't think of JavaScript living in a Elixir package, but in this case it does because we have a live component that depends on that JavaScript and that specific version of that JavaScript. So I was kind of actually curious, Dan, you asked about upgrades a minute ago and I was like, I don't actually know, but now I'm looking at the code. If I apply an update and I change either the organization or how things work on the components in the JavaScript, as soon as you update to that next version, you're going to get all the JavaScript and the component code upgraded. If there was anything that was going to break your live views, then that might require changes to the live views. Because I assume some people are going to accept the default. Some people are going to see the live views and want to move things, rename things. Maybe they put things in a menu nav bar instead of a separate page. You know, there's a bunch of stuff people can do once they've got the code generated. But looking at the demo repo, which has a bunch of other Phoenix code in it, I don't see any of the generated JavaScript in there. It's just the default Phoenix JavaScript and CSS.
And I was meaning more like the Elixir depths that are within the components library. Like, you know, right. That GitHub percentage is going to include all that.
Right. So that, yeah. So the GitHub it's looking at, there is Elixir code that here that will technically be in your depths folder, but won't be called. So like the tasks are Elixir code, the components are Elixir code, and there's a bunch of templates, which are EEX files, if I remember correctly. I have not actually added the EEX extensions, but they are templates. They're, you know, named .ex for now. I would love to talk about generators next, but that's registration component. I think authentication component is one we didn't quite get to, but basically what it does is whenever you go to an authentication page or you hit the authenticate button, there you don't actually need to enter a username or email. As soon as you click that button, the operating system is going to present to the user any passkeys that are registered for this domain. So that may just be one passkey in most cases. But if I've, say, like I've got a developer account, a marketing account, my personal account on a site, then I would see those three passkeys presented. And I could choose at that time, who am I signing in as? Developer, marketer, or just guy, you know? And then the authentication component basically does a slightly more complex dance of, all right, which key ID did this user select? Do we have a key ID matching that in our database? We will form a challenge. The challenge will go to the browser. The browser will handle that challenge, respond to the server. There will be an attestation. And once that whole process is finished and successful, we create a session and then we put the user back into the application as assigned a user.
There you go.
So bing, bing, bang. Bob's your uncle.
So you said you want to talk about generators. What do you want to say about generators?
Okay, so y'all know I've been on a generator kick lately. I've been writing.
We do.
This, yes, internally for our team, I've been writing generators that are not related to this project. And this is all Zach Daniels' fault. He was on our podcast episode one this season. Go back and watch that episode if you haven't already. He's talking about Igniter, which is a really cool tool for building mixed tasks. Low-hanging fruit is being able to generate new code. So generators are like the first thing you can do there. He recently added some abilities for refactoring and patching or refactoring code. So one of the things that Igniter is really nice about is it allows you to patch code. So Web Auth and Components currently is just a set of mixed tasks and templates and components that your application uses. The tasks that I've written they're really easy for the stuff that's just copying templates and injecting, you know, module and application names. The stuff that's a little bit less great is stuff where I have to inject code or patch code. So for like the mix file, for config files, I think I've used Sorcerer to do that. So that's looking at the AST. You're kind of like pattern matching on where you're at in the AST when you're using Sorcerer. Igniter makes that a little bit easier, actually much easier in some cases. And I think there's even a few places where I might be using regex or regular expressions where Igniter might allow me to use something a little bit more reliable. I even heard yesterday that they're debating whether or not they want to start parsing the JavaScript AST so you could do some real, you know, reliable JavaScript modifications. But that's one where, like, you know, I just have to look at the app.js file and figure out where to inject the hooks. I'm going to do my best effort with regular expressions, and then you're going to see it break if you've already got hooks in your application, so you'd have to manually fix that. One thing that I will do eventually once I have a little bit more bandwidth is go back, revisit the tasks that I've written, and refactor them using Igniter. Maybe split out tasks so you can kind of opt in and out of different things. And that would enable you to potentially, I think this goes back to the goal we were discussing a few minutes ago about maybe I've already got authentication. I just want to add another option for my users of passkeys. And you wouldn't necessarily want to run the full generator. You might want to run just the registration generator. So then that would kind of hook into your existing system. So I think that would open the door to a little bit more customization and opting into things instead of like it's all or nothing currently.
Right.
Mm-hmm. This sounds like some nice added flexibility. Be able to kind of pick and choose.
Right. I'm all about developer experience.
Yes, you are. Know,
like you could like, look, anyone before this package existed, you could do this, right? There's mm-hmm. nothing blocking you aside from browser and operating support. You could have written all this code. The problem is, you know, security is such a crucial factor on every application that we deal with. There's maybe a couple of examples where like there's no users and no security necessary. But what, 99% or more of applications need strong authentication and security. They have strong requirements for that. And, you know, passwords just aren't cutting it. Multi-factor just isn't cutting it. So that's why passkeys exist. And that's why I wanted to make it easy for developers to do the right thing and to use something that will increase their security, not only for themselves, but also for their users. So when I say yourself, like, if you've got a database full of passwords, that's worth money, like real money, right? Because like there are people on the internet, dark web or otherwise, who their mission in life is either to make you miserable or they see value in the data that you have. So as long as you have that data in your database and it can be used, then, you know, you're going to be under attack and you're staying up at night worrying about potentially vulnerability of that data. So passkeys kind of removes at least that vulnerability from your system. You still got to think about, you know, securing and encrypting other PII in your application. This doesn't solve every security problem, but it does solve one of the most common security vulnerabilities, which is usernames and passwords.
Awesome.
Let's say that your device got stolen that had passkeys on it, and maybe your iCloud password for the keychain was not very strong. How easily could someone integrate into this the ability to require user presence whenever a passkey is used? You know, maybe that's, you know, they're do a fingerprint scan or something like that, that's biometrics, but some way of that other kind of like human presence second factor to the passkey.
There's an acronym that I think touches on this. This may be one of those so far in the weeds details that I can't fully explain here. What's coming to mind is UVPA. I'm trying to find the actual description of that. That might be a different thing. There's discoverable passkeys. There's user presence. I'll try to describe how I think this works in layman's terms, and then, you know, I can be corrected by the internet. So passkeys, as far as I understand, do require user presence. So, and that's the user of the operating system, right? So here's another scenario that came up when I kind of presented this for the first time. Let's say I were a dad. Maybe my cat has access to my laptop, right? So okay. I've already signed into my laptop. My laptop's open. The keyboard, the screen's on. I've got, you know, the browser open. What if my cat goes to my bank account and wants to take all my money? Can't they just access my bank account now because I've already signed into my laptop? No. So the way passkeys works is it uses the same credential platform, either from your hardware or from your cloud provider where you're storing the credentials. But whenever you go to a site or an application that requires web authentication, it's going to ask you to authenticate again using your Face ID or Touch ID or whatever your platform security, you know, is configured for your passkeys. So there are a couple flags you can set in, I think, web authentication components that are passed through down to the browser that allow you to control some of this. Like, do we accept physical USB keys? Does it have to be a passkey? There are a few options there. It's not fully configurable from this library currently, but that is something I do want to extend the ability for application developers to control every option that's available in JavaScript through the Livy code. That may be something we kind of stretch into, but to my mind, I think the user must be present before they can register or authenticate to your system, because the operating system is going to request their biometric ID before it allows them to proceed into your application. And there's a timeout. So if they wait too long, I think it's 30 seconds by default, maybe 60 seconds. Hmm. Once that timeout passes, the browser will push a message to the WebSocket. The server will receive that message from my component saying this request timed out. Try again.
Let's say we've convinced everybody to do this. What kind of feedback are you looking for? What do you think your next steps are? How can somebody get involved?
Right. So I guess if you listen to this and you just want to hear different versions of what we've talked about today, one resource is the Elixir Conf talk that I gave, where I introduced the library and published, I think, the night before on stage, the web authentication components. So that talk is available. I think that one's nice because it's got slides, it's got animations of a very kind of like oversimplified version of like how this thing works. But yeah, if you're interested in looking at the source code, I definitely recommend taking a look at web authentication components. We'll have a link to that, I'm sure, in the show notes. And also web authentication components demo will show you kind of what your application would look like once you've actually run the command. And I try to keep those in sync so that whenever I make updates to the library, I will also, as long as I remember, I will update the demo app as well. Like I said, I do have a small set of issues. So if you, the listener, are running this on your application and you run into a problem or something is unclear, definitely open an issue on web authentication components so I can answer your questions. We can discuss if we need to make any changes. There are a collection of existing issues, like I want to add telemetry, I want to support multiple keys for users and that kind of stuff. So if you are intrigued and you want to jump and open a PR, definitely welcome PRs as well. I typically can respond to issues and PRs usually within 1 to 2 weeks, you know, kind of depending on what's going on out in life. but yeah, so I think issues and PRs are great. I've also got a thread on the Elixir forum, so I'll find that link and make sure we have that in our show notes as well. So if you just want like a more of a freeform discussion.
Awesome.
But yeah, so you got a few ways to jump in if you want to contribute or just use the library.
Great.
Well, this was super interesting. I think, you know, there's a lot here. And I think you've created an on-ramp to an important and hopefully more common technology for us to make web applications and everything more secure. Also, a lot here throwing back to our conversations around generators and pulling library code in and things like that. So a lot of rich kind of intersection of what we've been talking about this season. Before we wrap up, Owen, any other plugs? You know, we talked about how to contribute and where to find you, but anything else you want to promote, or how can people get in touch with you? Not about WebAuth stuff.
That's a can of worms. Let's leave it at WebAuth and components. It's a big topic on its own. I think if people are opening issues in PRs, I'll be super happy, because, you know, I'm not a security researcher or an expert by any means. I'm just a guy who spent a few months kind of researching and building a thing that people could use. So I have had a conversation. I've got some improvements I want to make to, you know, how we store sessions and tokens and things, just so that there's not other vulnerabilities that might be laying around in the repo. So I do want to eventually make this a 1.0 release. So there's a few things I want to work on before we get there, but that would be the biggest thing, is if you find vulnerabilities you want to report, open an issue or a PR if you know how to fix it. And then if you just want to talk things through, hit me up on the forum. I've got the thread open and we'll chat.
All right. Well, thanks for your time, Owen, and thanks for helping us make our web applications more secure.
Yeah, let's get rid of passwords. Thank you.
100%.
Something we can all agree on.
Elixir Wizards is a production of Smart Logic.
You can find us online at smartlogic.io, and we're at Smart Logic on Twitter.
Don't forget to like, subscribe, and leave a review.
This episode was produced and edited by Paloma Pichenik for Smart Logic.
Thanks for joining us in the Creators Lab, and we'll see you next week for more stories of innovation with Elixir.
Hey, this is Yair Flicker, president of Smart Logic, the company that brings you this podcast. Smart Logic is a consulting company that helps our clients accelerate the pace of their product development. We build custom software applications for our clients, typically using Phoenix and Elixir, Rails, React, and Flutter for mobile app development. We're always happy to get acquainted, even if there isn't an immediate need or opportunity. And of course, referrals are always greatly appreciated. Please email contact@smartlogic.io to chat. Thanks, and have a great day.